Okay, let me begin with the rabbi story for this hour. Every week there was three clergymen that would meet. One was a priest, one was a Protestant, one was a rabbi. Each week they would decide what topic they would discuss from the three different perspectives, and each week it'd be somebody else's turn to be first, second, third. On this occasion, the topic they chose to discuss is how did each one decide how much of their income they give back to God? Was the priest turned to go first, so he says, here's how I do it. I go outside, I draw a circle in the ground. I stand in the middle of the circle, and all the money I received that week I throw up in the year. What falls inside the circle, I keep. What falls outside the circle, I give to God. And the Protestant minister says, I find what you say interesting because I do something similar to you, but not quite the way you do it. Like you, I go outside. What I do is draw a straight line. And I stand on top of the line. All the money I received that week, I throw up in the air. What falls left of the line, I keep. What falls right of it, I give back to God. Rabbi says, I find what both you men say very interesting because I do something similar to both of you, but not exactly the same as either of you. Like both of you, I go outside. Like both of you, all the money I received, I throw up in the air. And what God wants, he keeps. What we've done is deal with the first six chapters of Revelation, pointing out in the first chapter is the first major portion of the book, the things that John saw. What he saw was the glorified Son of Man. The second part of his book, which he himself divides, is the things which are. The things which are the seven churches. And now the rest of the book deals with the third main division, the things which must come to pass hereafter, meaning after the period of the seven churches. And we have three series of judgments, of which we covered just the first series, and that is the series of the seal judgments of Revelation chapter 6. At least we covered the first six of the seven. And then chapter 8 and 9, he'll cover the second series, which covers the second quarter tribulation in chapters 8 and 9. But in between now, we have chapter 7. And chapter 7 tells us what's happening during the whole first half of the tribulation. The whole first half when the seal judgments are coming and the trumpet judgments are coming. Now, if you have your maps, here they are. The map you should be looking at is the one on page 4, which covers the first half of the tribulation. And we already covered the seal judgments on the left-hand side. Now we're going to deal with one of the events of the whole first half, and then we'll move into the seven trumpets. So we have the 144,000 in the worldwide revival. What I haven't pointed out yet is there are three major purposes for the tribulation. And the first major purpose is to make an end of wickedness and wicked ones. To make an end of wickedness and wicked ones. You'll find this in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 8. Isaiah 13, verse 8. Also Isaiah chapter 24, verses 19 and 20. Isaiah 24, 19 and 20. And these three series of judgments, the seal, the trumpets, and the bowls, is to carry out that first major purpose. Now, the third major purpose, which we'll discuss as we move into chapter 12 of this book, is to bring about Israel's national salvation, Israel's national regeneration. The one we're dealing with now is the second major purpose. The second major purpose is to have a worldwide preaching of the gospel and a worldwide revival. And you'll find the statement in Matthew 24, verse 14. Matthew 24, verse 14. The gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world to all nations before the end comes. And this chapter, we see two things. First of all, in verses 1 through 8, the means of proclaiming the gospel. And secondly, in verses 9 through 17, the results of the proclamation. See how you have three reasons to make an end of wicked months, beginning with chapter 6, the worldwide revival here in chapter 7, and the breaking the power of the holy people, which can be redefined as being about Israel's national salvation, is what he'll deal with in chapters 12 and 13. So the means of this proclamation is in chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. What it does in verses 1, 2, and 3 is deal assign the four angels who are the guardian angels of the four winds. So certain angels control the north, south, east, west winds. Sometimes it's for the benefit of humanity, but sometimes not for the benefit of humanity. There are helpful winds, there are also many destructive winds. He tells them not to destroy any of the vegetation, no grass, no plants, no trees, until the servants of our God are sealed on their foreheads. And so, as the tribulation now begins to start, they're not to hurt anything until the servants have been sealed on their foreheads. Now, the sealing is finally accomplished in verse 4, and what he points out, he seals 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from 12 different tribes. And sealing was done for two purposes in ancient times. Sometimes sealing was done for service, but sometimes sealing was done for protection, and sometimes for both, and both play a role here. So the first purpose is for service, and these are the 144,000 God's going to use to proclaim the gospel throughout the world. There's an advantage of using Jewish people for this purpose. First of all, there's still more Jews outside the land than inside the land. And the Jews are still dispersed all over the world. And except for American Jews, most Jews are at least bilingual, speaking two or more languages fluently. In fact, my parents spoke five languages. My father is gone now, but my mother's still living. She's 94 years old, still not a believer. But she speaks, originally, before coming to America, she spoke Russian, Polish, Yiddish, and German, and picked up English, a kind of English, because she learned it in Brooklyn, New York. And she's still living. Not open the gospel at this stage. I'm still praying for her on a regular basis. But she became a believer. She could already witness in five different languages without having to go to language school. There's a Jewish believer now with the Lord. He was the son of the founder of CPM, Christian Chosen People Ministries. He was fond of saying, you'll find the Jews in all seven continents, including the continent of the Antarctica, because everyone has heard about the icebergs. If you know something about Jewish names, you'll get the pun. And there's a story about this. There was a man who had an argument with his wife. He finally just left the house, slammed the door shut. He's walking down the street, he's very angry. And he sees a Chinese man coming down the street, so he goes up to him and belts him. And the Chinese man asked him, what was that for? The man says, that was for Pearl Harbor. He says, Pearl Harbor? That was the Japanese, I'm Chinese. The man says, Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, Korean, you're all the same. Now the Chinese man is angry. He's a Jewish man coming down the street. He goes up to him and belts him. And he says, the Jewish man asked him, what was that for? And he says, that's for sinking the Titanic. The Titanic, that was an iceberg. Iceberg, Goldberg, Rosenberg, Silverberg, you're all the same. And so God will use these 144,000. We'll learn from chapter 14 later, these are all single males because the situation in the tribulation is not conducive to marriage, having children, having families. And by means of these 144,000, he'll fulfill that second purpose to bring the preaching of the gospel around the world. But secondly, they're protected from death. And therefore, these are 144,000 Jews that will survive that seven-year tribulation. And as we get to chapter 9, which we'll do later this morning, we will notice that when there is a demonic invasion for the purpose of tormenting people for 5 months and also killing the one-third of humanity, They're told not to harm anyone that has the mark on their forehead, not be the 144,000, based upon verse 4. What happens now is in verses 5 through 8, he begins to enumerate one by one the 12 tribes from which the 12,000 will be taken from each of these 12 tribes. And the whole focus is on their Jewishness. He could have just simply made a general statement, 12,000 from 12 tribes, but he goes on to list tribe after tribe after tribe to focus on their Jewish identity. This will help to counteract the rise of replacement theology that began around the 4th century, where they claim to be the spiritual tribes of Israel, a very cultic groups that claim to be the tribes of Israel, the 144,000 as Jehovah's Witnesses, for example. Now, people have often noted that there seem to be two tribes missing, the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Dan. Actually, the tribe of Ephraim is not missing because Joseph basically produced the two half-tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Sometimes, as in Ezekiel chapter 37, Ezekiel 37, Joseph's name could be used for Manasseh or could be used for Ephraim. And Manasseh is mentioned in the list. What is not mentioned is Ephraim, but Ephraim is under the tribe of Joseph in that passage. So the tribe of Ephraim is not missing. The one tribe that is missing is the tribe of Dan. As I mentioned in my introduction yesterday, people have provided all kinds of different guesses as to why the tribe of Dan is missing, but only guesses. The man who discipled me taught me very well that teach the Bible for everything it teaches, but when the Bible stops, just stop. Don't keep going. Don't speculate. Don't make any guesses. Don't date the rapture or the second coming and so on. And so all of these guesses, like the Antichrist will come the tribe of Dan, or the false prophet in the tribe of Dan, or that Dan was the first tribe to fall into idolatry, etc. Those are all guesses. But as we emphasized yesterday, what we need to do is go back to the Hebrew Bible, because much of revelation is based upon the Hebrew Bible. And you can see other places where a tribe is missing. The issue is this. If you list all the tribal names, how many names do you have? 13. Not 12, but 13. Now, Jacob had 12 sons, but the right of the firstborn, which was given to Joseph, and the right of the born receives a double portion. So from Joseph, you have two half-tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, listed as separate tribal names. So again, if you list the names of all the tribes, you'll always have 13 names. So to maintain the symmetry of 12, you have to drop a name. So on the screen, notice Deuteronomy chapter 33. That is where Moses goes to his 12 tribal blessings. And when he finishes his 12 tribal blessings, you'll notice the tribe of Simeon is missing. It's now listed in Deuteronomy chapter 33. And everywhere I travel, people almost always ask me, why is Dan missing from Revelation 7? Nobody ever asked me, why is Simeon missing from Deuteronomy chapter 33? It shows everybody reads Revelation. Nobody bothers to read the book of Deuteronomy. And this does not help Moses maintain his royalties at all. But the reason he drops Simeon is to maintain the symmetry of 12. This is not on the screen, but if you go also in Ezekiel chapters 47 and 48, he talks about how the tribes will be settled in the future Messianic kingdom. What is noticeable is that Dan is there. He'll be the most northern tribe in the Messianic kingdom. And he lists the other tribes, but the tribe that is missing from the settlement is the tribe of Levi. He deals with Levi in a separate category altogether. But to maintain the symmetry of 12, he drops Levi. For the same reason that Moses dropped Simeon and Ezekiel dropped Levi is the same reason John drops Dan. is to simply maintain the symmetry of 12. It's that easy. So going back to Hebrew Bible is always helpful to understand these things, and it works better than trying to give guesses that have no biblical relevance. This is the way he'll fulfill the promise of Matthew 24:14, the gospel will be proclaimed to all throughout the world, to all nations, before the end comes. Now, in verses 9 through 17, we see the results. As we all learn, as we witness, it's one thing to present the gospel, it's quite another what the results will be. And here we see the results. Because what John sees in verses 9 and 10 is multitudes, myriads of people in heaven. They've come out of every nation, every tribe, every single language group. And verse 11 and 12 describes the people worshiping the one that is sitting upon the throne. Then in verses 13 and 14 comes the identification of the multitudes. I think we should look this up. So turn to Revelation 7 in your Bibles, whether in your book or by the telephone. And one of the elders, this is verse 13, one of the elders answered, saying unto me, these are arrayed in white robes, who are they, once came they. And I said unto him, my Lord, you know. And he said, these are they that come out of the great tribulation. And they washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So notice these Gentiles who came out of the tribulation as believers. And they're great, and they are dressed in white robes. And again, white robes throughout this book is a symbol of salvation. And by means of, and the reason they are white is because of they wash those robes in the blood of the Lamb. So the result of the preaching to 144,000, myriads of Gentiles will be saved. And God will accomplish his second major purpose for the tribulation in this manner. And the chapter ends in verses 15 through 17, dealing with the comfort they enjoy. In verse 16, for example, they shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun strike them upon them, nor any heat. For the Lamb that is in the midst of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall guide them unto the fountains of the waters of life, and God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. And so as a result of the 144,000, myriads of Gentiles will come to saving faith, and that's how they'll accomplish the second major purpose, the great worldwide revival, by means of the 144,000. And again, this is going on in the whole first half of the tribulation. That brings us now to the second series of judgments, the trumpet judgments, comprising chapters 8 and 9. Here again, the chart that you have on page 4, we're now moving from the seven seals, and from the 144,000 to deal with the second quarter of the tribulation on your chart, which will be the seven trumpet judgments. Now, by way of introduction, keep in mind we only saw so far the opening of the first six seal judgments. And so what's going to happen in verses 1 through 6 will be the prelude. And notice in each of these series of judgments, there's always a prelude in heaven before the judgments come upon the earth. So the prelude to the seal judgments were the events in heaven in chapter 5. In that chapter 8, verses 1 through 6, there's the prelude in heaven before the outpouring of the trumpet judgments. Look at verse 1. And when he opened the seventh seal, there followed a silence in heaven about the space of a half an hour. And as some people interpret verse 1 as evidence that there will be no woman in heaven, because they stay silent for a whole half hour. That's not my view. I'm telling you what those other guys are saying. But because of the enormity of these judgments compared to what happened with the seal judgments, there's a silence in heaven about a half hour time. And then in verse 2, the seven angels that are going to be dealing with seven trumpet judgments are given the trumpets. And verses 3, 4, and 5, what you have is the events in heaven preceding the blowing of the seven trumpets. And he points out there was incense added to the prayers of the saints. And notice the golden altar, because the altar is symbolic of the prayers of the saints. And therefore, the prayers you already heard of in chapter 6, the fifth seal saints, when they prayed to God by the altar of incense, that God will avenge their martyrdom. The response of God was, there are yet others to be martyred, but he will avenge them. And now what he will use is the trumpet judgments to finally render judgment to those guilty of martyring them. And so, verse 4, the smoke of the incense with the prayer of the saints goes up before God. And then the angel that played the center will begin to deal with the fire of the altar and cast the fire to the earth, and there will be following thunders and voices and lightnings and a great earthquake. We'll notice how often an earthquake precedes or follows the series of judgments. And so these convulsions in the heavens and situations on earth just introduce the next series of judgments. As we come to verse 6, the seven trumpets are then handed out to the seven angels. And now we're going to see larger things, certain things in percentages. Now, in Isaiah chapter 24, when it describes the judgments in the tribulation upon the earth in general, he points out there was such massive destruction, often by fire, so that by the time the 7 years have run their course, few people are left. Few people are left. And as these judgments keep pouring out, we get key percentages. By the time the 7 years run their course, about two-thirds up to three-quarters of the earth's surface is destroyed, equal percentage of the earth's population. Just as Isaiah 24 says, humanity becomes more rarer than gold, more than the fine gold of Ophir. So the first trumpet judgment, it will destroy one-third of the earth's dry surface is destroyed. That includes those who live in that part of the world. Then the second trumpet blows in verses 8 and 9, which will destroy one-third of the salt waters. And he mentions that includes all the ships out there with the people in them. They will die. There'll also be a massive destruction of the sea life and things of that nature, and one-third of the salt water supply for the earth. And the means by which God will do so, he says, a great mountain burning with fire. On one hand, this may be a meteor, or maybe a volcano. But what it is, we're not 100% sure, but what we do know, the results are purely supernatural. This is something that cannot be explained merely naturally, but supernaturally. And so the sea turns into blood, just like once the now river turned into blood, destroying all life and destroying all ships. Then we have the third trumpet judgment in chapter 8, verses 10, 11. Now this destroys one-third of the freshwater supply. Now again, when the word star is used symbolically, it symbolizes an angel, could be good or bad. In this case, this is God uses a fallen angel, fallen by virtue of his name being Wormwood. And this fallen angel would be the one to destroy one-third of the earth's fresh water supply. Then we have the fourth trumpet judgment in verse 12 that destroys one-third of the light sources are destroyed in some way. It could be taken from the Greek in two ways, but Greek allows either way. First of all, it may mean there are actual destruction. So one third of the sun is destroyed, one third the moon, and one third the stars. But the same terminology can also mean that the light does not penetrate the earth. So the sun does not penetrate the earth for one third of the normal daylight, and the moon, the stars, do not penetrate for one third of the night. So it will be one way or the other. Now, after dealing with the first, second, third, and fourth trumpets, which has already destroyed major parts of the earth, he has a little prelude. And in verse 13, there's a prelude to the woe judgments. And it's made by the eagle-like seraph that we read about earlier, yesterday in Revelation chapter 4, verse 7. And now the seraph makes the announcement, as bad as the judgments of the trumpet judgments of numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 are severe, the worst severe judgments will come with the fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpet judgments. And so these are also called woe judgments. And the severity is seen as we move into chapter 9. The first and second woe judgments are two demonic judgments for two different purposes. And the third woe judgment are the seven bowl judgments. So look in our chapter 9. In chapter 9, we have the fifth trumpet judgment. Now, here's an example where he simply goes back to something in the Hebrew Bible and tells us when this fits. So going back to the book of Joel, chapter 1, verses 15 through 20, where he describes the day of Jehovah, the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord. Now, that is the most common biblical term in both Testaments, for we now call the tribulation. Our most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation, but the most common term in Scripture is the day of Jehovah, the day of the Lord. It's always the time of severe divine judgment before the establishment of the Messianic kingdom. And that's also true in the context of Joel. So as Joel describes this massive army in verses 15 to 20 of chapter 1, verse 15 is their approach. They're very well organized. In verses 16 and 17, the results on the crops will be massive destruction. So that verse 16, little remains to be offered up in the temple. This would be the tribulation temple. Not only for the temple, even for sustenance in verse 17, there's also massive destruction of the livestock. Continuing into Joel chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, there's the sound of an alarm. One of the purposes of the alarm trumpet sound is to warn for alarm taking place. And in verse 2, describes the day of Jehovah. In verses 2 through 9, he describes their invading army. As you read the passage, it's not a human army. And so in verse 2, describes their approach. Verse 3, their devastation. Verses 4 through 9, describes the army. In verse 4, their appearance. Verse 5, their noise. Verses 5 and 6, their terror. Verse 7, their speed. In verse 8, their strong discipline. Verse 9, their attack. Verse 10, their results. Massive destruction of human life, animal life, earthly life. And verse 11 gives the reason for the invasion, and that is a judgment for sin. Now, from the background of the Hebrew Bible, let's look at what chapter 9 says. And in verse 1, he says, the fifth angel sounded, I saw a star from heaven fallen unto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss. So as verse 1 opens up, notice he describes it as a fallen star. To whom the key of the abyss is given. He's not using it literally as a star, but when the word star is used symbolically, it symbolizes in both Testaments angels, whether good or bad. This one is a fallen star. This is a fallen angel, but a key fallen angel, as we'll see. And he's given the key of the abyss, and the abyss is a section of Sheol or Hades, which is a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels or demons. Again, it's a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels or demons. Did I describe this yesterday? Did I talk about the abyss yesterday? Okay. There's a section in the earth, in the center of the earth, called in Hebrew Sheol. In Greek, it's Hades. Sheol and Hades are the same place. One is Hebrew, one is Greek. It's a place in the center of the earth, and as you read the Hebrew Bible, everyone who dies goes to Sheol. Could be the believers, the unbelievers, you all end up in Sheol. However, Sheol had two main compartments, a good side and a bad side. The good side is where Abraham's bosom was, because before Messiah died, when believers died, they could not go right to heaven. And therefore, they had to go to the place called Abraham's bosom, which was where paradise was located at that point. And then the other side had three divisions. There was hell for unbelieving humans. At the very top, at the very bottom, is a place called Tartarus, T-A-R-T-A-R-U-S, T-A-R-T-A-R-U-S. And Tartarus was a place, a permanent place of confinement for those angels who sinned in Genesis 6, been intermarrying with human women and producing the Nephilim. And so these will never be free to roam free again. But in between hell and the Tartarus is the abyss. And the abyss is a temporary place of confinement for fallen angels or demons. So sometimes when a demon is cast out, he'll spend some time in the abyss, but eventually be released. As when we get to Revelation 20, we learn that's where Satan will be confined for 1,000 years, but also says then he will be released. It's always temporary. And there are demons confined there right now to be released for these judgments we're going to find in chapter 9 with the two different demonic invasions. You might recall the account when Jesus was confronted by a legion of demons. And those demons asked them not to send them into the abyss. That would be the normative situation. But they asked them not to send them into the abyss, but allowed them to leave the person there indwelling and infest a whole herd of swine, a whole herd of pigs. For some reason, Messiah allowed them to do so. We don't really know why. It had nothing to do with kosher laws, because the location geographically was on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and the east side was all Gentile. The west side was Jewish, the east side was Gentile. And the kosher laws applied only to the Jews, not to the Gentiles. So it was not a kosher issue concerning those pigs. If I don't like to guess about scriptures, I like to end with the Bible lens, but now and then I find myself engaging in some guesswork. And I would suggest that Jesus did that to provide a biblical basis for a popular Gentile food dish called deviled ham. And now you know where that came from. So this angel with the key to the abyss will come down and he'll open the abyss. And the opening of the abyss results with the third blackout. For the third time, no light comes to the earth from the sun, moon, and stars. And in verse 3, out of the abyss arises a great army of demons that look like locusts. They look like locusts, but they sting like scorpions. And this is the first of two demonic invasions in the tribulation, the first of two such demonic invasions. And in verses 4 and 5, they're given a commission. They are not to hurt any of the vegetation on the field that's already been damaged by the previous judgments, nor are they to harm the 144,000 Jews, because, as I mentioned, one of the purposes of the seal was to give for protection, and the seal may not be visible to humans, but will be visible to the spirit world. It's not to hurt any of the 144,000. And the third element of their commission is they are not to kill anyone, but simply torment people for a period of 5 months, which is 150 days. They're not to kill anyone, but to torment people for 150 days. And the torment will be so great in verse 6. Many people will try to attempt suicide to avert the pain, and every suicide attempt will fail. For 5 months, nobody dies. So any attempt to try to skirt the pain and the torment is going to end in failure. Now, verses 7 through 10, notice how they're described. And he's describing demons, not humans. Verse 7, and the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared for war. And upon their heads, as it were, crowns like unto gold, and their faces were as men's faces. Their hair like the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And their breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was the sound of chariots of many horses rushing to war. And so what he describes in these, and also through verse 10, they have tails like unto scorpions, and their stings and their tails as in their power to hurt men for 5 months. A very popular prophecy writer on his book Revelation says, he says he's describing American helicopter gunships. Well, gunships don't come from the abyss. They come from the factory here on earth. These are demons. And the fact that they come out of the abyss shows them to be demons. In verse 11, notice he now identifies who the leader is of this first demonic invasion. He was a fallen angel in verse 1, but now we're given his Hebrew and Greek names. His Hebrew name is Abaddon, Greek name is Apollyon, but both the Hebrew and Greek word mean the same thing. His name is Destruction with a capital D. His name is Destruction with a capital D. And then you have this small interlude that now the first woe has passed. However, there are two more woe judgments to come. Okay, let me mention another book that you might enjoy. It's also a biography. This is the biography of a woman named Ruth Waddell. She's the one that led me to the Lord. And she was a Gentile believer who was Canadian that God moved her down to New York City to work with the lost Jewish community of New York City. And so this is her biography. And by the way, this was put together by Jeff Goodman. You'll find here a long history. She also has a section of her responses when she first met me and began witnessing to me and how I came to faith. You can see her version in this and so on. So this is a book about my spiritual mother in the faith. I forgot to mention one thing in presenting this brochure. We're not passing the offering plates here, but we have a pushki box, which is Yiddish for the offering box. And if you wish to contribute, you can put the funds in there. But if you want to receive a receipt for the amount you're giving today or tomorrow, in the upper left-hand corner, mark down what portion, what your gift is for an amount. We'll be happy to send you a number of receipt for income tax records. This should wrap our story before the break. There was a priest and a Catholic priest and a rabbi they got together often and got along pretty well. One day the priest decided he wants to show how much more opportunity the priest has in the Catholic Church than the rabbi has, because Judaism does not have a hierarchy. So rabbi is just a rabbi. And so when the priest met with the rabbi, trying to impress the rabbi, he says, "Rabbi, I'm only a priest right now, but you know, someday I could even become a bishop." Thinking the rabbi would be impressed by this, the rabbi simply shrugged his shoulders and says, "Well, that's nice." But the rabbi was disappointed. I mean, the priest was disappointed with that response, so he tried another tactic. "Rabbi, could someday become the archbishop?" And again, Rabbi shrugged his shoulders and says, that's also nice. And now the priest is getting rather disappointed. He says, Rabbi could someday even become a cardinal. That should impress the rabbi. But again, Rabbi shrugged his shoulders and says, that's also nice. And now the priest is getting upset and says, Rabbi, I could someday become the Pope himself. And Rabbi shrugged his shoulders and says, that's also nice. And now the priest is really angry. And he says to the rabbi, what in the world will take me to impress you? Do you expect me to become God himself? Rabbi said, well, one of our boys made it.